Hi, everybody. My name is Johnny, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here tonight, and I'm glad to be sober. I'm glad to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank the committee for extending the privilege of participating in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I've come to believe, and more so today probably than ever before, that it's some type of a privilege to even be allowed to come and sit in these rooms. I hope I don't ever get it through my sick head that I have a right to everything that goes on in Alcoholics Anonymous just because I was lucky enough to stumble into here and get sober and stay that way. Anything that I'm asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, I consider it some type of an unearned gift. I really can't figure out what I ever did in my life prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous that would allow me to operate the way I do today. So I just have to assume that it's some type of an unearned gift. And I was told when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous that my sobriety was a gift from God. And I wanted to know what I had to do to give God back, and they told me what I did with my sobriety would be my gift back to God. And so I hope that I can keep it shiny and precious and new, and the longer I stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, the easier my life seems to get. There doesn't seem to be much of a chore anymore. There doesn't seem to be too many uphill climbs. There doesn't be too many fights and too many chugs, too many problems. My life seems to be... I finally got it down after a little over 40 years of being sober to one day at a time. I mean, I don't want to drop anything too heavy on you, but that's about as deep as I'm going to get tonight, I'll tell you that. And, so that's about the extent of my conversation and about the extent of everything that I know about it, except that... I had a sponsor one time, he was my sponsor, my dear, wonderful, devoted sponsor who's dead now, named Norm Alpie. And he gave me a piece of information one time when I got a little cocky in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been down in Texas when we were talking at a conference, and I was a Sunday morning speaker, and I was at that ripe old age, you know, about 10 or 12 or 13, where you've just learned everything there is to know in AA, and you're just kind of right along on that spiritual crest, hand in hand with God. You know, I mean, you recognize them, a few people. They have their own interpretation of what Bill was trying to say in their books. They're writing books better than Bill knew how to write. They're just wonderful folks, I suppose, for Christ's sake. But anyhow, these people I was down there with some fine old members of Alcoholics Anonymous, these guys down there, some great old Texans that I knew, and they talk, I'm talking Sunday morning, and they're fine, and so I'm sitting there Sunday morning having breakfast, and I said, I guess everything's been said. So maybe I should take them through the steps. And so I got up Sunday morning, and about 15 minutes into my talk, I got lost. And I struggled and fought and snuck out of there under a cloud of darkness and threats of life and all this other kind of stuff. But I told him about the steps. And I got home that night, and I long trip home, and about a half hour after I got home, the phone rang. I picked up the phone and said, Jackass? Which that's what he called me. I said, Norm, I'm a little tired tonight. I haven't got time for any of your nonsense. I've had a long trip. He said, where were you? And I said, I'm down in Texas. He said, what were you doing down there in Texas? And I said, I was giving a talk. Hey, talk. He said, that's not what I heard. He says, I heard that you were down there lecturing them people on the steps. I just, oh, yeah. He said, I'm going to give you a little bit of information, Jackass, for the rest of your life. He said, if you can't go in there and tell them what it was like, what happened to you, and what you were trying to be like today, then you ain't got no business going. We don't need any experts in Alcoholics Anonymous to tell us how to do things around here. That's what we have sponsors for. And so I guess it's been 30 years maybe now that I've been given the great privilege of sharing my experience, strength, and hope in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never, ever in my life ever want to forget those kind words that man said to me on that telephone that night. Because I have one of those monumental egos, and if I get to thinking I know something in Alcoholics Anonymous that any other alcoholic doesn't know, I'll be a dead man inside of 6 months. I don't know why I'm sober. I know a lot of people have an idea because there's some type of special people or something. I really don't know why I'm sober. And I don't take it for granted because it's the most priceless thing in my life, my sobriety. It's the thing that I cherish above all things. It doesn't mean that my conduct is always above reproach. It doesn't mean that I've always been the greatest example of Alcoholics Anonymous who's ever come down the pike. But one thing I have never done, I have never sold out Alcoholics Anonymous in any way, shape, or form. I've always idolized this program of recovery called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've always done what I've been asked to do here. Now, I didn't know that where I got this thing. I don't know where my disease came from. I haven't got the slightest idea. I know some people think you're born with it. I don't know. I was born needing an answer, I can tell you that. And to make matters even worse, I didn't even know what the problem was. You see, it's awful hard to find the answer to a problem if you don't know what the problem is. And I didn't know what my problem was. Now, I'm restless and irritable and discontent, but I don't know then, as I've come to understand here with you good people, that those are the symptoms of the most deadly disease that's ever been known to mankind. My sponsor tells me, and I have no reason to doubt him, that there's written history of our program, or our disease, alcoholism, that stretches back almost 5,000 years. It's written history. And in probably that 5,000 years, it's probably killed more people than anything that's ever been known to mankind. Now, that's what I have. I don't know I got that. I know a lot about whiskey because I come from a bunch of whiskey-drinking people. They were all Irish folks. They had no religion to hold their guilt down, so they just went crazy, them people. They were just nuts. I mean, they made whiskey, and they sold whiskey, and they did what people who drink whiskey do, things like that. In a little town in Kansas that I was born in, my uncle went to penitentiaries, and my aunts worked in them whorehouse on the other side of the tracks. Mom and Dad got drunk and beat each other up. A tag team night at the Harris household on Saturday night. Every once in a while, they had nothing else to do, so they'd crawl over there and beat the hell out of me. I saw what whiskey did to people a long time ago. And my reaction with that was, I don't remember it being, I didn't know until after I was in therapy for a period of time that scarred me. I didn't have any idea about that at all. I just didn't know what happened to me. Just said to myself, I'm not going to drink alcohol. That's what it said to me. Look what these people do who drink alcohol. They get drunk and they do all these crazy things and they beat each other up and they steal each other's women and they go to penitentiaries and they do these strange things and I'm not going to drink whiskey. So I started looking for a way out of this dilemma a long time before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Matter of fact, I believe that my entire lifetime was spent searching for what I found in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous on the fourth day of November 1959 when I came to you good people. I think everything that I ever did led me right up to that door. I remember sitting as a child watching my grandmother leave on Sunday morning and be gone for a couple hours and come back, and she had something about her, a lightness about her, an easiness about her, a spring in her step, and she'd sing songs to Jesus, and she would clean up after these crazy people and cook for them and bandage them up and iron their clothes and clean them. I'd take a look at that thing, and I didn't understand what was going on about my grandmother, but I made another serious mistake. I thought that all I'd have to do is go where my grandmother goes and do what my grandmother does, and I'd be like my grandmother. I'm not like my grandmother. My grandmother's not an alcoholic. I didn't know that. I didn't know that I was bodily and mentally different from my grandmother. I didn't know that. And so I didn't know those kind of things, so I went over and sat in my grandmother's church with my grandmother and waited for this magic that happened to my grandmother to happen to me. I mean, I don't think it happened. I just sit there. And what I've come to discover in Alcoholics Anonymous after many, many years of being sober here, and that there was nothing at all wrong with my grandmother's church. Nothing. There was something wrong with the jackass sitting in it, I can tell you that, but me. But what I was doing sitting in that church is what I did all my life prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time after I was here. I'm looking for something out there to make me feel better in here. And that only goes to prove that the problem's always been there. Always been there. This search, this longing, this whatever it was. The answer, the temporary answer that I found to life, I found sitting on the back porch of my grandfather's house watching my grandfather drink whiskey out of a fruit jar. My grandfather put that fruit jar down and I picked it up and took a drink of it. That's all I did. The next couple of minutes of my life into this kind of thing is what makes me an alcoholic. Oh, I'm not an alcoholic because I spent the next 20 years of my life creating mayhem out there. I'm not an alcoholic because I became one. I'm an alcoholic because I have some type of an abnormal reaction to alcohol. And what I damn near died learning is that everybody who drinks alcohol does not get the same reaction from it that I do. I didn't know that, because alcohol was a wonderful thing in my life. It was probably the greatest thing that ever happened to me in my life. Alcohol was never a culprit with me. I took a drink of alcohol and something happened to me. That feeling came over me, that whatever feeling it is that happens when you come to these things. It's kind of hard to explain it if you're not an alcoholic. But it happened to me, this feeling that reaches up into my head. I didn't care what was going on. I just didn't give a damn anymore. That's all. I had found something that just gave me a sense of release. It took away the madness. It took me from the black pit of nothingness and stood me into the gray fringes of the business of living and stalled in me some type of agaricance that said, damn you, world, it's all right. It's okay right here. That's a powerful thing. And something like magic in your life, you don't give up too easy. But you see, that's not the thing that drove me into in gates of insanity and death and beyond. What got me is what our book talks about. It says it happens to alcoholics of my type once I ingest alcohol into my system. Once I put it there, not before I put it there, but once I put it there, it tells me that I'm triggering some type of phenomenon of craving, that I'm drinking to overcome a craving that's beyond all human help and beyond all human understanding. I didn't know that. Because what happened to me when I drank alcohol happened to me every time I drank alcohol for the next 20 years of my life. Every time I took a drink of alcohol, the same thing happened to me. I took a drink of alcohol, and 3 days later, they pulled me out from underneath a bridge and stood me in front of a judge and sent me to the Hutchinson State Reform School. 20 years later, I took a drink of alcohol. They pulled me out of a car in Compton and stood me in front of a judge and sent me to 20 years in the penitentiary. Now, that's what happened to me when I drank. I got drunk and went places. I just traveled around out there. I went from reform school to junior penitentiaries to penitentiaries to nut houses. Now they call them treatment centers. I kind of like nut house better. It's a little more macho. Hell, if you're going to be bad, you ought to be bad. I mean, I don't think you ought to quit drinking because you puke a little. Hang in there. Give it everything you got. Alcoholics Anonymous work a hell of a lot better when you run out of options. I gave it everything I had. It beat me into an absolute state of nothingness, and I didn't have a clue what was wrong with me. I didn't know what it was that got me. Because I never one time ever came out of one of them institutions in my 20-year career as a ward of the state of California and the federal government. Never one time to ever walk out of one of them institutions and say to myself, self, do you realize it's been a long time since you've had a series of those electroshock treatments? Why don't you have a drink? I didn't say that. I didn't say to myself, self, why don't you have a drink of alcohol and go out and kill your baby brother? Why don't you have a drink of alcohol and go out and destroy everything in your life, self? Why don't you have a drink of alcohol, go out there and get torn to pieces and run everybody in your life off and slaughter and do things out there that people like you do? Why don't you do that stuff? No. I never one time ever took a drink of alcohol with the idea of getting drunk. Because I didn't want to be drunk. I didn't want to be out of control. I took a drink of alcohol after being sober for a period of time. The reason alcoholics of my type take a drink after being sober for a period of time, it's just to go, whew. See, that's why alcoholics of my type drink after being sober for a period of time. But you see, that's all if you're an alcoholic. That's all that's required. Because then the phenomenon of craving takes over and you're drinking it to the bitter end. I didn't know that. So my only chance in life, I suppose, is not to put myself in a position where I don't have to take a drink. You see, I'm an alcoholic. And if you put me in the wrong place at the wrong time in the wrong set of circumstances, I'll be drunk. It doesn't make any difference how many meetings I've been to, how many people I sponsor, how long I've been sober, how spiritually fit I am, for Christ's sake. Put me in the wrong place, at the wrong time, in the wrong set of circumstances, I'll be drunk. I'm an alcoholic. That's my only salvation. It's the only thing that's uppermost consciously in my mind today, is that I don't ever put me in them places no more. I try, to the best of my ability, one day at a time, to keep in some type of a peacefulness within me where it is necessary for me to have to drink. And I don't go into slippery places where slippery people are. No, I don't know all that. I don't know all that sitting on a furlough from reform school, 10 or 11 years old, drinking a bottle of Marco Petri red wine. Most of you have never heard of Marco Petri red wine. You know why? It was the experimental stages of Thunderbird. That's why you never heard of it. I'll tell you how bad that stuff was. It never saw a grape. But it gets you. Now, I'm drinking this stuff this day. I'm sitting on the street corner with my little gang down there on a... Well, it was 133rd in Wilmington, right smack dab in the big metropolis of Willowbrook. That'll be macho if you want to really get it. Where are you from? I'm from Willowbrook, baby. What happened to you in Willowbrook? They threw me out there and made me go to Watts. I was corrupting the people there. I'm sitting there drinking this stuff, and I hear people talking Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. I'm not saying it's true. I'm not saying it's not true. It's just not my experience. And anybody who talks to you in Alcoholics Anonymous beyond their experience, don't listen to them, because it doesn't make any difference to anybody. My experience is, I hear people say, alcohol just quit working in my life. Good. What the hell are you doing here? If alcohol quit working, what are you doing in AA? You know why I keep going to 5 or 6 meetings a week? Why I still have to have a sponsor stronger on my head? Because right back here in the middle of my mind, where I live, is the knowledge that when I can't stand life on life terms any longer, I know what makes the big hurt go away. I know what makes it go away. That's why I have to come to meetings. That's why I got to do all this stuff. Now, sitting on that street corner that day, I guess this stuff ain't taking me where I want it to take me. I guess that's the size of it. The guy tapped me on the shoulder and said, you ought to try these. And he gave me some pills. Now, I don't remember saying to him, what are those? Will they bother me if I take them? Took them. Thank God they weren't X-Lax. That's all I can tell you. Could you imagine the type of program we could have now with that 12-step deal going on with that stuff? Work, that's all I can tell you. Thank God it worked, because a couple of years later, I'm sitting on the same street corner from another reform school, and I'm meeting these pellets, and I'm drinking this cheap wine, and I guess I was just there at the wrong time, at the wrong place, or the right time, at the right place. I don't know. Maybe it was a salvation for me. I don't know. A guy stuck a needle in my arm. And for the next 14 years of my life, I stuck needles in my arm, and I ran in and out of institution. That's what I do. You see, I live out there in the streets, and I do what people like me who live in the streets do. I destroy everything that comes in contact with me. There's a reason for that, you see. I'm a taker. I'm a taker of things, and I'm a user of people, so therefore I'm a loser. I'm selfish, I'm self-centered, and I'm self-serving. I got an ego bigger in this whole room. My entire lifetime was spent before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. For a long time after I was here, and maybe even a great deal of time today, I really don't know, without a conscious thought or a conscious concern for any other human being who lives upon the face of this earth. I wasn't interested in you at all, unless you had something I wanted. Then when I got it, I cast aside like so much trash, I went on about my business. That's the way I lived my life. Well, I didn't live my life like that one day or one week or one month until the heat got on. I lived my life like that from my earliest recollection of life, till a long time after I was an Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened to me a little over 41 years ago is that I came to in a cell in solitary confinement at a maximum security penitentiary, drifting in and out of total insanity. And what's significant about that to me today is I walked through the halls after I got here, and I saw people that I've known for years, and people that I love, and people who love me, and I put my arms around them, and I'm shaking hands and doing all this kind of thing. 41 years ago, crawling around in that cell, there wasn't a single solitary soul left upon the face of this earth that would send me a penny postcard. They were all gone. But they should be gone. And I don't have any right to have any of them back. I don't have any right to have anything good and decent in my life just because I was lucky enough to stumble in here, get sober, and stay that way. Everything that's good and decent in my life is some type of an unearned gift from this God I discovered sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with you. That's all. It's not anything that I have a right to. It's not what I deserve. If I got what I deserve, you better hope you can clear the room before I get it. That's all I can tell you. Because I don't know about anything at all, but I do know that I've adopted a thing. in the last few years of my life, maybe since 1984, since my papa died, I picked up a little thing that he does, and I live with it practically every day of my life. I want to spend the rest of my life trying to wipe out that record. That's all. And the only way I found out I'm able to do that is become an active participating member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I don't know how to do anything else. And I got to do this for free and for fun. I don't know all that stuff in itself. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, thank God, on the fourth day of November, 1959. I can't take any credit for coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. If I'd have known where I was coming, I wouldn't even have come. So how in the world could I take credit for anything good and decent that's happened to me since I've been here? If I'd have known where I was coming today, I wouldn't have come. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because the institution I was in let women come in there. That's all. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous over 40 and a half years ago to smell perfume. And I've been honking and sniffing around her ever since. You know, I've said that for a long time. I've been saying that for almost 30-some years now. But I guess some of it's true. I guess maybe that was the attraction that sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's not the reason I came. Nope. I had a chance to look back on my life for a long, long time. And you see, my last time out in the jungle, I killed me for all intents and purposes. Ended up in the old Los Angeles County Jail, strapped down on a bed in the old prison ward, 128 pounds of bright yellow tied down on the bed with a doctor standing at the foot of my bed telling me I was going to die. And the reason I was going to die is because I'd had 2 years doing exactly to me everything I wanted to do to me, anytime I wanted to do it to me, with all the money I needed to do it with. And that's what happens to me when I run my own life. I get along very well out there. I laid in that bed that night, which that doctor told me that waiting to die. And all day passed and all night passed, and I laid there thinking about it, and some type of an idea came upon me that maybe I was going to live and not die. Maybe I was going to get up out of that bed and go to that penitentiary and come back out and start that rat race all over again. I didn't want to do that. And I didn't know what to do about it. And I laid there in that type of pitifulness, agony and fearfulness that I was going to live. More frightened, much more frightening to find out you're going to live if you don't know how than to die. Die's a welcome relief to an alcoholic. That's what an alcoholic searches for, I suppose. And one night, because I knew nothing better to do, I screamed out the only prayer I ever said in my life. I said, "Oh God, help me." I thought for a long time there was nothing happening because there was no blinding flashes of light. Nobody come running down the hall with a dozen donuts saying, "We got an AA meeting down there." I didn't get up and wander off into the tulip somewhere. I just went to sleep for a little while. And I don't know how many have ever kicked a 2-year heroin habit, but that's what I was doing. That's the first time I'd been asleep in a long time. Tell you how sick I was. 2 weeks later, I'm up running around the jail looking for some more of the poison putting me back on the bed I just gotten off of. And the reason for that is the same reason I talked to you about, because right back here, in the back of my head then, it is today. And I know that when I can't stand life on life terms any longer, I know what makes the grief hurt go away. Now, maybe it wasn't working, but if I can find the right combination of things, it will. It always had. It has to. For God's sakes, if it doesn't, I'm doomed. So I got loaded again. Many years later, I ran around with an old man who was the only father I've ever known. He used to talk a great deal about surrender, this old man. He'd say, "Surrender," and the room would rock. It's just an amazing old guy. And one time we were riding somewhere, and I asked him a question. I said, "I want to ask you a question, Pop." He said, "What do you want to know?" I said, "I want to know if I didn't surrender with the same depth on my deathbed in the old Los Angeles County Jail as you did on your kitchen floor in Beverly Hills." He says, "Why, sure, son. Why? Not a doubt. Why?" I said, "How come I got loaded 2 weeks later and you didn't?" He kind of laughed. He said, "That's very simple." I said, "How so?" And he says, "You got to surrender every day." What a novel concept. What a wise old man. Every day, this is the day you surrender. This one. This is the day, right now, the day you surrender. No yesterdays, no tomorrows. No past, no present. It's right now. Isn't that an amazing thing to do? Right now, there is no problem. Right now, there's only love and admiration and warmth and happiness. Tomorrow, the problems arise. Because tomorrow, you think about yesterday. I moved in and sat down in that room in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that day in November and sat there and stared at the answer I'd sold my soul for. But I didn't recognize the answer. I don't know what the problem is. It's hard to find the answer to a problem if you don't know what the problem is. And I didn't have a clue. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I sat there and stared at this thing. I didn't know what was going on. I told myself funny little things. I'd wait for the women to get up and tell their racy stories. You got to remember that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there weren't very many young, pretty girls hanging around here. And if they were, they weren't sitting up that penitentiary where I was at, I'll tell you that. These old gals got out to talk, and one of them said she'd drank for a long time, and you could look at her, know she'd been somewhere for a long time. And she said, I used to drink. I said, I'll bet you did. Bad stuff, too. See, I knew everything when I got here. I'm a walking encyclopedia of useless information. I know so damn much about what ain't true, I don't know what is true. And there I sit, for all intents and purposes, a dead man. Ain't got a clue what's wrong with me. My life had depended on it. If you'd said to me, if you'd asked me, I don't know what I'd have told you. I hadn't gotten into the age of victimization yet, so I didn't know what it was. So I didn't have a clue. I'm fascinated by these people. I don't understand these people. These people are doing things I don't understand. They're getting up on Sunday morning and they're giving up their days. They're buying their own gas, their own gasoline. They're buying their own lunches. They're driving 180 miles up those old back roads, all day trip. No freeways, no day. They spend 2 hours talking to a room full of people that didn't want to listen to them. People like me who sit in the back row and made fun of them. Let me tell you how sick that is for anybody that's too hip for the world. Here I am sitting in a penitentiary. I don't know when I'm going home. And I'm making fun of people who are leaving in an hour. Oh, but I'm hip. I'm so hip the balls of my feet tickle me when I walk. You know, a guy asked me a funny question the other day. I thought I'd share this with you. He said, you've been sober a long time in AA, haven't you? I said, yes, I have. Fine. He said, AA's changed, hasn't it? And I thought for a while. I said, yeah, in a way. He said, well, how's it changed? And I said, well, when I got here, the men had tattoos and the women wore earrings. You know, I sat in that room that day and looked this thing over, and it didn't like it was the answer to my problems. My old sponsor, Norm Alper, used to talk a great deal about crossing over some invisible line from controlled to uncontrolled drinking. I don't have any qualms with that whatsoever. I don't know where the invisible line is. I think it's 2 inches behind my tongue, but what the difference does it make? There's an invisible line in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my experience. That's a fact based on my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's an invisible line here, and if you're an alcoholic of my type, and I don't know whether you are or not, if you're not, it doesn't make any difference. Your life's not in jeopardy. If you're an alcoholic of my type and you don't cross over the line, you're going to die drunk. Or you may go insane, or you may blow your brains out. And that's a line where you got to cross over from being a taker to being a giver. And see, I don't understand anything about givers because I'm a taker. Takers don't understand givers. Takers only hang out with takers. That's why they're all losers. But I'm gazing at these people, and they're givers, and they're giving a little just for the hell of giving it. I don't understand that. I've never seen people like this before in my life because I never hung out with people like that. And when I asked them questions about what I got out of coming up there, I wanted to find out what they got out of coming up there. They gave me great answers, like deep answers, like, well, son, when you can answer those questions, you won't have to ask them. I wanted something you could really get into. You know. I wanted my intellect, my sick intellect and ego, wanted me to have something to work on so I could get some rewards for all this good thing that's happened to me. That's a sickness all on its own. To take some type of credit for all the blessings that's been bestowed on me in Alcoholics Anonymous is some type of a sickness I hope I don't ever get afflicted with again. I got up one morning and went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no way of knowing that day when I woke up it was the day I'd lived my lifetime for, because I didn't know it was the day I'd lived my lifetime for. If I'd have known that day that I was going to go sit in a room and somebody was going to open up the gates of hell or let me out of there, I wouldn't have went to an AA meeting. You see, I was not conditioned to go to AA meetings for answers. I was conditioned to go to people who had little things up on the wall that said they knew more than I did. I've conditioned to go to preachers and teachers and wardens and lawyers and counselors and all these other people. Those were the people I was conditioned to go to. But I didn't go that day because I didn't know what was wrong with me. I wasn't conditioned to go to alcoholics for answers. I went and sat in that meeting that day, and a little guy that I knew did 23 flat years in the penitentiary. Stood at a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and gave me the answer to the key to life that I'd been looking for all my life. He said very simply to me that I didn't have to live this way no more if I didn't want to. He says, you don't have to do it like this no more. Nobody had ever told me that. They've been telling me all my life not to drink, swallow, smoke, and shoot. They've been telling me since I was that high in every institution I was in, Johnny, if you don't drink these things and swallow these things and smoke these things and shoot these things, you won't have any problem. Every time they told me that, they never took this into consideration, any of these great learned men. Every time they told me that, I was as physically sober as I am right now. How many times I wanted to scream out at them, good God, doctor, don't you understand? Because they don't. If you're not an alcoholic, you'll never understand why I drink. But if you're not alcoholic, I'll never understand why you don't. You ever watch some of them people drink? I don't know what you call them out there, but they make me mad, tell you that, wasting that good stuff. A couple, 3 months ago, my lovely wife and I were on a plane trip. We were coming back from Dallas, and they kicked us up in first class because it was oversold. And we're sitting there, and the plane left the ground. The stewardess ran down. You had pictured like you're something in first class. They really don't know, but you can act like you're something up there anyhow. They poured this woman a glass of wine. And she sits there with it. Finally, about 20 minutes later, she put a pillow up and took a nap. A little while later, the stewardess woke her up and gave her lunch, and it still sit there. She ate her lunch, gave it back to the stewardess. The wine still sit there. I know because I'm watching it. I got my eye on her. But I'm thinking all the time, drink! Karen says, what is she doing over there? I said, why don't you go over and ask her? You know, just... You know, when we got ready to land in Long Beach about 3.5 hours later, she hadn't touched that wine. And I'm vivid. I must have had 14 cups of coffee. I don't know how much orange juice. I've ate 2 boxes of peanuts. And I'm just watching her all the time. Just... She wasn't the least bit worried about me at all over there. She just... It's amazing, isn't it? You know, I went up to this little man because I knew this little man. You see, this little man was my baseball coach when I was a star second baseman for the San Quentin Pirates. Well, I don't think that's funny. I was good. You know, I put that on a resume one time. I had a sponsor who required for me to tell the truth. So I had this opportunity to get this job to go sell oil tools over in Arabia. And so I knew they weren't going to let me out of there anyhow, not with my record. You know, they probably inspect the oil tools or something. So he said, I'm going to go get this application. He said, now you fill out, tell the truth, Johnny. I said, okay. And they have a thing on them applications, you know, about sporting activities and education and stuff. And I put down there, star second baseman for the San Quentin Pirates, 2 years running. Handed it to him. And he looked at it, you know, and looked at me and looked down at that thing. He said, San Quentin? I said, yeah. He said, where's that at? I told him, that's up near Stanford. You know what he said to me? He said, my, that must be a good school. I said, yeah, I learned a lot of things there. So I didn't get the job because they got me out of the country. They couldn't get me back, for Christ's sake. I said to this little guy, how do you learn how to live, Les? That's all. His name was Les Hamlin. He's dead now. He'd been dead a long time. So sweetest little man who never lived, for as violent as he was. And he said, "Johnny, there's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous in the library. If you go home and get it, I'll go home and pray that you find some part of you in it." That's the greatest piece of information that anybody can give a newcomer here. Our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, if you're an alcoholic, you don't need to know anything else. You don't need to have any type of instructions whatsoever, because if you apply what those first 164 pages in that magnificent book tells you to apply you to, your life will get better. It'll get better. If you fulfill the conditions of the first 164 pages of our book of experience called Alcoholics Anonymous, something will happen to you. Something good will happen to you. You won't have to drink anymore. That hole in your gut will get closed up, and that spiritual unrest within you will be at rest at last. You won't have to put a spirit in you to get a spiritual experience. You will be living a spiritual life. You know why I know that? Because it happened to me. It happened to me in the next 19 months of my life while I sit in that penitentiary with only a book called Alcoholics Anonymous and the people who came in there on a weekly basis. I didn't trust people. I didn't like people. I didn't trust people. But people told me they were in that book, so I went into that book. The greatest single event that ever happened to me in my life was not getting sober here. I was sober when I got here. The greatest single event that ever happened to me in my life is not my children being born or my grandchildren being born or the good life I lived today or my lovely wife. Not at all. The greatest single event that ever happened to me in my life happened to me sitting in a room with a man doing what our program of recovery says is a fifth step. I heard myself say to that man that I was an alcoholic. And from way down deep inside of me, there came a freedom that I carry with me to this very instant. I know what's wrong with me. If I stand here before you, I know exactly what's wrong with me. I'm an alcoholic, and I suffer from a disease called alcoholism. I am not an alcoholic and anything. When I was an alcoholic and something or other, I couldn't have your program. I separated me from you. I'm not like you. I'm a little better than you. I'm a little worse than you. I'm a little smarter than you. I'm a little hipper than you. I'm a little slicker than you. But I'm not like you. When I became just like you, alcoholic. At least the way it's explained in our book of experience. It became absolutely my great privilege to try to live in the only program of recovery for alcoholics of my type in 5,000 years of recorded history. I try to live in this program. I don't always do it well, because I'm a basic human being with faults and egos and self-centeredness and selfishness and self-serving. But from that moment of commitment to this very moment, I've known exactly what's wrong with me. I've never wanted to be anywhere else, doing anything else than what I've done. Nothing. Ever. And when I walked out of that penitentiary on the 4th day of June, 1961, to a world I didn't know anything about, I was armed with something. I had already, you talk about freedom. I had already gotten free. I got free sitting in that penitentiary. I got free when I walked out of that man's office after taking my fifth step. I got free when I sat down and started to write those amends, those letters of those amends when I was in that penitentiary, because that's what my book said I was supposed to do. I started to get free. I know all about freedom. I got free inside of a penitentiary. Freedom, being locked up or being walking around out here. There's people sitting around here in deeper bondage than I've ever been in. Deeper. My book don't talk anything about some type of a gate being closed. My book talks about a bondage, a selfishness and self-centeredness. Since that seems to be the root of our problems here. So I must be rid of it or it's going to kill me. All I was armed with when I came out of that penitentiary was the first 9 steps of this program of recovery to the best of my ability while I was confined. My dream was that maybe you'd let me come and sit in your meetings. I never dreamed you'd ever ask me to do anything, because I didn't think things like me who crawl out from underneath rocks were allowed to sit next to you good people. Not at all. I said to myself, allow me to do it. Allow me to come and sit in your meetings. I'll do anything you ask me to do. I'm very proud tonight to stand here and tell you that in almost 39 years of my life, Everything that Alcoholics Anonymous has asked me to do, I have done. And I have done it sometime grudgingly, but I have always done it. And it's always been my great pleasure to do it after I've already done it. Not before I'd done it. I didn't know what that was going to entail because I went to a meeting one night and started to be introduced to something I didn't know anything about. I started to be introduced to a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous, which is entirely different than our program of recovery. Our fellowship, you see, is made up of people. And people all have feet of clay. All people have feet of clay. There ain't no perfect people here. If you're looking for that, go by the pool. And they're dancing around out there. They only made one perfect person in the history of the world. They hung him on a piece of wood. Not because he was perfect, but because he frightened people. You know, the reason we're all here, the reason Alcoholics Anonymous is such a wonderful thing, so I've been taught, is that we're all bound together by a common flaw as alcoholics. One alcoholic is bound together by another alcoholic by an unnatural, unseen flaw that binds us together. This deadly, serious thing that one alcoholic talks, another alcoholic listens. And it only happens from one alcoholic to another alcoholic. On. And so I come to meetings of alcohol. I went to this meeting. This guy, this skinny-legged guy, told me he's going to be my sponsor. His name was Norm Alpe. God, he was a mean, ornery fellow. He asked me to do things, like get a job. He said, you should go to work, Johnny. You're a bum. I told him, no, I'm not a bum. He said, what are you? I said, I'm an AA member. He said, no, you're an AA bum. Bums don't work. He says, you got to get off that welfare, too. And I said, don't you ever say that to me again. I'm going to hit you if you say that to me. I've never been on welfare. He says, what do you call living in penitentiary? Self-supporting through your own contribution? Get a job, you bum. Got a job. Wasn't the kind of job a big high-rolling, dope-dealing pimp was supposed to get. Working in the oil fields. And they only let me work out there when they'd have nobody else to work. I didn't know how to do anything. I tell you some things that I thought about this the other day when my lovely bride and I were having dinner in a nice restaurant yesterday. I was thinking about one day I'm out there working in the oil field down in the harbor, and we got no power stuff. We got them big 36-inch pipe wrenches and big snipes. And I got no gloves because I can't afford a pair of gloves. And I break this pipe out of the hole all day long, 10, 12 hours all day long. And I tear my hands to pieces and just blistered and bleeding. And I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night at the old institutional group in Long Beach. They called me up to the podium to talk. And I got to the podium and looked down and saw my hands, and they were battered and bruised and bleeding, and I broke down and started to cry. I'd never seen my hands like that. But I wasn't crying because my hands were bleeding. I was crying because of this magnificent program of recovery called Alcoholics Anonymous, and a sponsor who was more concerned about my life than he was about my feeling insisted that I behave like a man. That I'd be out there and go out and do a day's work for a day's pay, no matter what it was. That I'd at least get out there and try to do for mine and pay for mine, not to stick my hand out and keep on taking from people. I've got to give a little in this world. That's what I was crying about. That's where my gratitude came from, because for the first time in my life, I had a feeling that a man's supposed to have, what a man is doing, what a man's supposed to do. Never had. I had a lot of money once upon a time. I never felt like that. I could look down at my manicured hands and my $1,000 suits and my big new automobiles and my fancy women. And I never had that feeling. Working out there for a dollar and a quarter hour in the mall field. That's what my sponsor gave me. He gave me that feeling of dignity by going to work, being a man, going to work, taking care of my wife and my little kids. What a great thing. What a great man he was. He wouldn't even let me drive a car because I didn't have a driver's license. He told me that citizens like him had a right to be protected from jerks like me. And I said, well, I've never been arrested for driving a car on a revoked license. He said, no, but you may drink, Johnny. That always seemed to be the conversation always came down between me and old Norm. And so I didn't drive a car until it became legal, until I had to have a car to go to work, and then my parole officer let me get one. And it went on from there. My mother fell off the steps blind drunk when I came out of the penitentiary, and I picked her up and put her on the couch and said, Mom, I'm going to an AA meeting. She looked at me and said, fine, I think you should. One of the greatest lessons I ever learned in my life, I was talking to Helen Louise about it out there in the hall today, about this old lady by the name of Myrtle Snyder, who was the closest thing to a mother I ever had in my life, old Myrtle. And my mother drank, and it became my business one day to try to get my mother sober. After all, I was sober, so I'm going to get my mother sober. And so the harder I worked on her trying to get sober, the drunker she got. And the drunker she got, the harder I worked on her. One day I found myself down on the floor. I had her by the throat and I slapped her in the face with a pamphlet on sponsorship. And just about the time she started to turn blue, I found out what I was doing. And it scared me, and I got up and I ran over to the old Lano Club over on Florence and Western. And I got out of the car, and I guess I was crazy because I was going to run across the street, and Myrtle was standing across the street. And she said, what's the matter with you, honey? And I said, just my mother. My mother. My mother won't get sober. I've been 3 days working on my mom trying to get her sober, and she's drunker than she was 3 days ago. I don't know what I'm going to do. And Myrtle looked at me and says, I really feel sorry for you, honey. Oh. You know how we are. She says, yep. She says, if somebody came to you tonight and really wanted help, you ain't got nothing to give. You've been sitting over there for 3 days trying to get somebody sober who obviously doesn't want to get sober. If somebody came to you and needed to get sober, you ain't got nothing to give. She said, remember this. You never want to deny anybody the privilege of suffering. I thought that was the cruelest statement that I've ever known. That's true. One of the great tragedies that I've watched erode in Alcoholics Anonymous in some places in the years, we seem to have people somewhere in this world who thinks they can rise somebody up to a level of despair by what they know. And that's not true. You cannot induce despair to a human being. That has to come between that human being and their God. And if you ever step in the way of that, you will become God. If you ever step away between anybody and their despair, anybody and their hope, the Al-Anons talk about it all the time. They talk about release. I don't know how well they practice it, but they talk about it a great deal. What I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned about a love of freedom. I love you. But I'll let you drink yourself to death if that's what you want to do. I'm not going to stand in the way between you and your God. My sponsor wouldn't stand in the way between me and my God. My sponsor just stood aside and let me do whatever. I run into them walls and bounce off of them, and run into them walls and bounce off of them. He always stood there and smiled at me. I always said to him every time I'd run into one of them walls, oh God, Norm, I ain't never going to do that ever again. He said, oh yes, you will. It's just in the nature of your illness, Johnny. You're going to get out there and your self-centeredness and self-serving, you're going to creep in and you're going to become too big for your britches and you're going to make decisions based on self and you're going to retaliate and you're going to hurt yourself. I said, what am I supposed to do? And he said, nothing. Nothing you can do. You just keep going to meetings. You try to help newcomers, Johnny. And you get out there and try to practice what you preach here if you can, best your ability. What a wise man he was. He taught me a lot of things. He taught me something that's very apropos to me because I learned it in an AA meeting with him one night. I used to ride with him to meetings all the time. The only two people I'd ever ride with was him, Papa, and I wouldn't ride with anybody else because I just didn't want to be around anybody else. See, I'm not a social butterfly. I'm really not. Big crowds scare me. I mean, I'd just rather go hide in a corner somewhere. Get out on the golf course and hide out back there behind a bush somewhere and beat the ball or something. But I went to a meeting with him one night, and I'm at literature table at the coffee break, and the guy tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Johnny, I heard you talk the other night." And I said, "You did?" And I said, "What do you think?" He said, "Man, you're a miracle." I said, "Really? What was it?" I said, you know how humble we are, for Christ's sake. He went on and on and on, and I just kind of floated back to my seat after about 10 minutes of this madness. I didn't even want to hear the traditions. I wanted to hear more about this talk I made. That's just what I wanted to hear. And so I kind of flit into my seat and stared out the window at this little place we were at, and I'm staring out the window looking for my spaceship. I know it's coming. I know. I mean, I'm a miracle, for Christ's sake. Old Norm's watching me. We're on the way in the car that night, and he's looking out the window, and I'm looking out the window staring at the stars. I'm trying to see which one's shining the brightest. He said, "Jackass, are you smoking that stuff again?" I said, "Norm, I don't think you're going to understand this, but I'm a miracle." Old Norm didn't understand that. He slammed on the brakes, damn near ran into the divider, and screamed at me, "You're what?" He said, "Where do you get this nonsense?" I said, "Then enable me." He said, "You're not a miracle, jackass." He said, "Alcoholics Anonymous is the miracle. You're just a small part of it." Now, I don't know what it does for all the miracles in Torrance or the South Bay. I can tell you what it's done for me. It's kept me small enough to stay here. You can't possibly imagine what an egotist like me would do if I thought I was a miracle. Let your imagination soar. Hire some buses. Take us back to Waco to do it right this time, for Christ's sake. I have an ego like, I know that. Then people say, "I am without ego." We've got the biggest goddamn egos in the world. People would say something like that. The next minute they'd say, "Did you see the crowd I talked at last night?" Well, I guess it's because you don't have ego. Yeah. That's why I have to have a sponsor who's stronger than my head. That's why I have to go to 4, 5, or 6 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a week. That's why I got to take my seat here and not be the member of AA or the great authority on our program of recovery, but just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who's willing to do what you ask him to do, make coffee, set up the meeting. Who cares? It's a big deal here. Some place you're supposed to go here. Some place you're supposed to reach here. When I was new, I used to think that. I say, "Oh, I'm supposed to go there, be something." That wise old man, my papa, told me, "Go anywhere here." You know, when I quit trying to go anywhere, I've been all over the world. When I quit trying to get anything, I've been given everything. You know what I have today? I have peace inside of me. I'm a God of my very own. I have a woman that I love more than I love myself. The only woman I've ever loved that much. I've flirted with a few of them, but she's it. If there's such a thing as a soulmate, I discovered her, of all places, in Columbus, Ohio. Columbus, Ohio is not much to shoot for on a good day. But my baby came from there, so it's all right, I guess. Life is awful good to me. You know, every once in a while, I don't know how you are, but every once in a while, two or three years ago, a little over 4.5 years ago, I guess it was, I thought I should get out of the relationship business because I wasn't good at it. And I ended up in bad shape because my ego always run wild on there. So I talked to my sponsor about it, and I said, he said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to get out of the relationship business." He said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "Nothing. I'm just going to go back and try to clean up the wreckage of my past, the wreckage of my present." So I spent a period of time trying to solidify my relationship with my children and my grandchildren, and going back and face to face, making some amends to old girlfriends and ex-wives, and didn't have any financial amends to make because I'd already made all them, and didn't have any of those kind of things to do. So I got free, and I just, Clancy would say to me from time to time, "Are you dating anybody?" And I said, "No." And then I went to Columbus, Ohio to talk at a convention, and Karen drugged me into her little web and captured me. We corresponded for a while, and 2 months later we got married. I tell you, I just batted my eye one day, and there she was at the door in Long Beach. Jesus. But we embarked on this thing. But I've heard people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about the love affairs. My old papa used to talk about it. I finally got around to, after almost 40 years of my life, being able to practice it. I said to him one time, I want to know what you and Mom do. I mean, you got a good deal going here. And he said, well, when I got sober, I went to Mrs. C. and I asked her, I said, if you allow me the privilege of loving you, I'll never ask you to do another living thing. I said, Jesus, that's easy to say. You know, I try to live like that today. You know, can you imagine what kind of a bonus it is when she cooks? I mean, it ain't very often, but I get very grateful when she cooks, for Christ's sake. And my relationship with my children are not always the best. And Norm died on my day before my 22nd birthday. And I had to go down a year later and get somebody to help me because I was self-will run riot. People would say things to me that, you've been sober a long time, you don't need a sponsor. And why don't you go talk to the people you sponsor? And I go talk to them. And I tell you, you don't want to talk to some of the people I sponsor, for Christ's sake. I mean, anyhow, I found myself sitting down at an office with Clancy, Jesus, 17 years ago. And I got ready to walk out of his office that day. I felt a chill run down my back, and I turned around and asked him. I said, Clancy, I need a sponsor. He looked at me, and I thought he was going to say, what an order, I can't go through with it. You're too much for me, hotshot. You know how you are. So he said, let's try it, Johnny. I said, give it a whirl. I said, what do you want me to do? He said, why don't you show up to the Wednesday night meeting and call me every day? Okay? I go to the Wednesday night meeting. I call my sponsor every day. He said to me not long ago, he said, some guy said to me, you still call Clancy every day? And I said, yeah. He said, why? And I said, he hasn't told me not to yet. Basically, that's simple with me. Basically, it's that simple. It's my sponsor. The man that knows everything about me there is to know. If he wants to tell you, that's fine. I don't have any qualms about it. He's the only man that I trust with my life. I trust my life to my sponsor. I have bet my life that my sponsor is right. I've only had 2 sponsors. If Norm Albee was still alive, he'd still be my sponsor. I don't believe in all those open door sponsorship. Whenever you find somebody to do it a little easier than the guy before you, you can drop off and do that. That's my experience with that. I want to be moved around. One of the great things that's ever happened to me in my life was my relationship with that old man who lived in Laguna Beach, who was the only father I've ever known. And he taught me many things, but the thing he taught me more than anything else is there was nothing special about me at all. When I tried to read him pamphlets about how we were chosen, he would tell me I was not chosen. He would tell me things like the rain falls on the just as well as the unjust. And I would say to him things like, then how come I'm sober if I'm not chosen? If I'm not special, how come I'm sober, for Christ's sake? I know people who are far better people than I'll ever be who can't get sober or can't stay sober. He'd say, that's simple. You've come to understand you're one of God's kids and you act like it. I said, what do God's kids act like, Bob? He said, oh, they just wander around and try to help God's kids get things done that need to be done. And they do it for free, and they do it for fun. What a wonderful life it is when you can live that way. I get to live like that a lot of times. I get to spend a lot of time with him the last year that he lived, and it's probably the greatest thing that ever happened to me. I watched this wonderful, magnificent old man that I adored and loved to death. I go down there and sit with him, and then I turn around and drive home and cry all the way home because I loved him greatly. Until Karen came to my life, I don't think I've ever loved anything like that in my life or anybody like that in my life. My children or my father or my grandfather or my mother, anybody. I love that old man more than anything. He was the only father I've ever known. And sometimes I miss him terribly. Sometimes. But he's always there because as long as I'm alive, he's going to live. And the reason he's going to live is because he left me a legacy. My sponsor, Norm Alpe, left me a legacy. They gave me a great inheritance here. They gave me this great inheritance that I can do with it whatever I want to do with it. I can take it and squander it if I want to. I can say, I've had mine, I've got mine, I'm going to enjoy it for Christ's sake. I'm going to come to a meeting every once in a while and sit around here. That's my inheritance. I've got this thing. I've been sober. I'm going to do anything I want to, and I can watch my inheritance leave. Or I can take this magnificent inheritance that I've been given in Alcoholics Anonymous from these fine men, and I can invest it very wisely in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people I sponsor. I can pass on to them the thing that was passed on to me and keep Alcoholics Anonymous alive for the way it was. You see, I don't want in my lifetime to make AA better. That would be some type of supposition that it's not good enough. I don't want to leave my mark, or I don't want to add to or take away or make it better. I just want it to be left the hell alone. I want it to be the same way it is today as it was when I got here 40 years ago. When a lost, frightened, scared little kid can wander into a room and sit down with a room full of people, and they can put him in their lap and rock him to sleep and love him until he can learn to love him back. That's what I want for Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want to change it or make it any better. I don't think that I have the capacity to make it any better. I just want it to be the way it was when I got here. That's all. I don't want it to be any worse because I was here either. I want it to be the same. I don't want it to be any better. What type of an ego would that take? What type of an ego does it take to think that as a fallible, weak human being, I can make this magnificent, God-given program better than what it is? One of the fine things that old man used to say all the time when he was with us, he said this, that the formula for sobriety and the formula for the good life are one and the same. So come on in. Sit down. Pick up a book. Pick up a cup of coffee. Sweep the floor. Want to know where I'm at? Come see me on Mondays. You know where I'm at on Wednesdays? Come and see me on Wednesdays. You know where I'm at on Thursdays? I'm sitting in an AA meeting. I'm sitting in AA meetings 3 times a week where I can listen. My sponsor, Norm, gave me a great piece of advice for egotists like me who talk a lot. He told me that for every time I talk, I should listen 3 times. And so I go to 3 meetings a week, every week, where I sit and listen. That's it. Because I have to hear the music. I have to hear God's kids talk to me. I can't be the kid that does the talking. And what that's done is just squeezed me right out of myself and kept me small enough that I can take my seat with you and just be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a fantastic thing. If you're new here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm by no wild stretch of the imagination an authority on this program. I'm an example, good, bad, or indifferent, that this program works. I haven't been anywhere else. I haven't investigated anything else. I haven't looked for anything else. I've just tried to incorporate what the first 164 pages of our book has instructed me to do. And I have followed the giants who walked before me. And I follow giants. Now, when I die and get to wherever I'm going, and I'm going to go someplace, it depends on who you talk to, which way it's going. But I'll tell you, if there ain't pretty flowers and birds singing and people like Papa and Norm Alpe and Clancy there, I don't think I want to go. Sorry. And I'll tell you why I don't want to go there. It's because before those people came to my life, I lived in absolute hell. And I know what hell's like. I lived there for almost 28 years of my life. But those people walked into my life, and through no invitation of mine, they took me by the hand. They led me right smack dab in the middle of heaven. I know what heaven is. Heaven is just a brand new pair of glasses. It all depends on how you're looking. As I see you stand here before you tonight, I want to tell you that I love you very much. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't restored me to nothing. Alcoholics Anonymous has made me everything that I am. It has turned me inside out and made me stand outside and take care of my responsibilities in the world. It's made me a father. It's made me a grandfather. And it's made me a husband. It's made me an employer, a worker among others. It's made me a coffee maker. It's made me a floor sweeper. It's made me a talker sometimes. It's made me a sponsor sometimes. It's made me a basic, fallible, weak human being who's in love with life and alcoholics. Everything I have in my life, I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything. Everything I may ever hope to have in my life, I will owe to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you better believe this. This is a long, long walk from a cell in solitary confinement, a maximum security penitentiary, to where I stand right now. But for the grace of God, AA, and good folks like you, I could have missed it all. Thank you.